What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
When you look back, I mean, four decades of doing Eagles play-by-play, when you look back as a whole, and obviously we're fresh off a Super Bowl win, but is there a moment that sticks out, like, specifically that you really love to harken back to?
February 4th, 2018. There's nothing like that.
From 94 WIP in Philadelphia, it's Wired This Way. Life stories about the people in sports, the choices they've made, and how they've achieved their success. I'm Andrew Porter. For me, a kid born in Philadelphia in 1990, there are two iconic sports voices in my lifetime. The first is the late great Harry Callis, of course, and the second is Merrill Reese. Merrill has been the radio play-by-play voice of the Eagles for 41 years, and that's how we know him, that's how we love him. He's the biggest Eagles fan there is. But Mer, as they called him in high school, has a lot more to his story than that, which I learned about during this interview, like his love for tennis, his basketball skills, and his short stint in the Navy. Merrill grew up in Philadelphia, and thanks to his mother's love for theater, entertainment was immediately a part of his life.
I had a wonderful childhood. My father, Nathan, was a dentist at 441 South 56th Street, which was where we lived in West Philadelphia. The office was attached to our house. My mother had been a kindergarten teacher before she was married. She was a stay-at-home mom. And she had a show business flair. And as a kid, she gave my sister, who was 3 years younger than I, we had singing lessons, dramatic lessons, dancing lessons, a lot of which I could have done without at the time. But she dragged us to the lessons and actually dragged me to do some television commercials. I did all kinds of commercials, mostly between the ages of 8 and 12. I did a radio show where I actually, it was called Let's Pretend, and I used to have to memorize a 26-page script every week. Wasn't allowed to read it. I had to memorize it. And that was good, because now I can memorize a 90-player roster in about 15 minutes. I guess the memorization work as a child, as a small child, really did pay off. And I grew up in a world where I just loved to play sports. And my parents took me to Penn football games on Saturday afternoon. Those were in the days when Penn would draw 60,000 fans and the Eagles would draw probably 8,000 fans at what was then called Shibe Park. But Franklin Field was the place to be for Penn football, because Penn was a national power and played all the big schools from all over the country. So I loved that, but I played every sport imaginable and just had those dreams as a kid of being an NFL quarterback, or of being the guy who hit the final jump shot to win the college basketball championship, or came in as out of the bullpen. I mean, in those days, the Phillies were, I loved the Phillies. They could park me at 4 years old next to a radio, and I could sit there and listen to an entire doubleheader. That's how mesmerized I was. And my early heroes were Phillies pitchers like Robin Roberts or Kurt Simmons. Richie Ashburn was a big favorite of mine growing up. and on and on. And, of course, the Eagles in 1960 won the NFL championship. And that, but I remember as a little kid listening to the championship games of 48 and 49 on the radio as a little kid. But I was actually sitting in Franklin Field in a corner of the end zone watching that championship game in 1960.
And then you went to Overbrook High School and Temple University, and your time at Overbrook, was that more focused on sports or journalism or broadcasting?
No, I lived for sports. I mean, that was it. I mean, I went out for the basketball team as a in 10th grade, and I was a pretty good little schoolyard basketball player with a jump shot, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to play much as a 10th grader, but at least I thought I would make the team, and I prepared by going through. I actually ran cross country that year in 10th grade to prepare myself to get really into great shape for basketball. And I remember the first day of practice, I came out, I pulled up, I hit a 15-foot jump shot. I looked over at the sideline at the coach, Paul Ward, and his back was to me. He didn't even look. So I came back the next time. I threw a perfect pass under the basket to a guy cutting in. Perfect assist. Looked over at the sideline. He wasn't even looking. Next day, I look at the list. I was cut. And the realization came to me at a school like Overbrook. There were tryouts because you had to have tryouts. But that team was recruited from all over the city. And here I am, a little 5'8 kid, trying to make a team that had three players who went on to play in the NBA. Wally Jones, who had a great career at Villanova and played for the 76ers for their championship team. Walt Hazard, who not only was a star at UCLA and then with the Lakers, came back and was the UCLA coach. And then Wayne Hightower was the big man, and he went on to play with the Baltimore Bullets. I was trying to make that team. Just wasn't going to happen. But I continued to play sports. I'd go to the schoolyard and play basketball until dark every night. Played football in the Saturdays with a bunch of guys, kind of semi-organized with equipment. And I was always had to be the quarterback, and loved every second of it. Loved to block, loved to tackle. Didn't mind the contact at all, but I loved it all, and I did everything I possibly could to just always be playing sports.
And then at Temple University, your focus shifted towards broadcasting.
Well, by the time I was 15 or 16, I realized that I wasn't going to one day be the Eagles quarterback. So I picked the next best thing, taking advantage of my background as a kid doing radio and television, and going to Franklin Field to watch the Eagles and looking up at the broadcast booth and seeing the great Bill Campbell. And in the yearbook from Overbrook High School, your senior yearbook, it was called the record book. It says, Murr, and that was my nickname, M-E-R-R, Murr loves sports, cars, girls, and dogs, and aspires to be a play-by-play sportscaster. So that was it.
Sounds good to me. Then, most people don't realize, but you did a short stint with the United States
Navy. Yeah, I was a naval officer, naval public affairs officer when I came out of college. And I was when I came out, I was a lieutenant senior grade. I was commissioned as an ensign, and then spent some time at CHINFO, which is the Office of Information at the Pentagon. So I was involved in naval public affairs. But that was a great experience, and I loved it. But then I came out of the service, and it was time to get a job. And I had a lot of confidence at that time. I had broadcast all of the Temple games. When I was at Temple, we had a line at the Palestra, broadcast line. So I not only did Temple games when I became sports director at the end of my freshman year, I did every Big Five game played for 3 years. I mean, they played all of the Big Five games were at the Palestra, and there was a Palestra doubleheader every Wednesday night. There was a Penn game every Friday night. There was a Palestra doubleheader every Saturday night. One Saturday, there was even a high school tripleheader playoffs, and I did a tripleheader of high school games on a Saturday afternoon and a doubleheader of college games at night. So I sat there and did five straight basketball games. So I did that. I did Temple baseball, and I did Temple football. So then after my naval experience, I was full of confidence, and I thought after coming out of the Navy that I'd go out and I'd get my first job. And I went to all the Philadelphia stations, and there was nothing there. And then I remember auditioning in Coatesville, and the station manager listened to me, and he said, "You can't start here. You've got to start someplace small." Now, this was Coatesville. Right. I figured, where can I find someplace smaller? Then I found out that the station manager in Pottstown was looking for somebody to do a high school football game on a Saturday afternoon. I went and I visited him. Herb Scott, his name was, and he looked at me and he said, "I'd give you a chance, but you look like you're about to have a nervous breakdown." I had no confidence, and because I had been out of the service over a year, still looking for a job. People used to say to my mother, "Helen, is your son ever going to work?" And but she was, you know, my folks, my mom was great about that. So I went on, and I said to the station manager, "You're probably right." I went home, and on Friday afternoon, he called me, and he said, "Listen, I can find absolutely nobody else to do this game. It's between you and Dead Air." And so on Saturday, I went to Pottstown, and I did a game between Pottsgrove and Springford. And as I started, I was pretty shaky. And then as the game went on, I started to feel more and more confident and finished the game. And on Monday, he called me and offered me a job, and a full-time job. And I worked for 7 days a week. I did the disc jockey show. I did a show called Highland Garden of Memories, where they played organ music and I read death notices. I mean, you name it, I did it. I did a Little League game every night in the summer. And that was the start of my career.
The good news was Merrill had a full-time job. The bad news was, A, he wasn't making much money, and B, he wasn't working in sports. Instead, Merrill was playing tennis, teaching tennis, and doing news radio in the afternoon. So he was busy, but he wanted to do sports. So what's the best way to get your boss to agree to let you do something? Well, do it for free.
By the way, yeah. 7 days a week, $65 a week.
Wow.
That was my salary.
Wow. And then you parlay that into more work at places like WIP,
well,
and WBCB.
Not, you know? So fast.
Okay.
Because I was in Pottstown for a year.
Okay.
Then I came up here to WBCB, mm-hmm. which is the station in Levittown where we're recording this at right now, where I am now part owner, managing partner, and general manager. I was here for 2 years, mostly doing news. And then I went into WWDB, which was an FM station connected with WHAT, which was a rhythm and blues station. And I went there as a newscaster. And I did news every day from noon until 8 o'clock at night. I do the hourly and half-hourly news. And to supplement my income, I was still not making a whole lot of money. I would give tennis lessons in the morning. Tennis was a sport that I spent a lot of time playing. I played a lot of tennis tournaments during the summers in college. I played 6 hours a day.
Wow.
And so I gave lessons for $7 a half hour, and that was not a bad rate at that time. And then I'd quickly run into the station, and I'd do the news all afternoon. So I kept asking the station manager, I said, I think I'd love to come in and do sports in the morning. And he said, "This isn't a sports station. It's primarily a jazz station." That's what DB was in those days. Mm-hmm. Sid Mark, who is still doing Fridays with Frank. Sid was the big afternoon star. And I would do the news. And they said, "It's not a sports station." So I said, "Well, listen, I have an idea. How about if I come in and do the sports at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and 9 o'clock in the morning, 5 minutes of sports, for free." Those were the magic words, "for free." And they said to me, "You know what? Sports might work here." So I went in and I did the sports every morning for free. 9 o'clock, I'd run home, give 3 tennis lessons at the courts nearby, and run back and do the news all afternoon. That's wow. What I did. after a number of years, I heard that WIP was looking for somebody, actually a guy by the name of Al Schreier, a dear friend, who was the sports information director at Temple, contacted me, and he said, WIP is looking for a summer replacement. Charlie Swift, their sports director, takes a month's vacation every year in the summer, the beginning of summer. He was the play-by-play voice of the Eagles. They said that he's going on vacation. This was in January. They asked, why don't you call Dean Tyler, the program director, and get an audition? And I did, and I got an audition, and I auditioned. And
what
I was
that? Was that like a quick audition? Like what?
No, I went in and they gave me copy, and I wrote up the sports copy, okay. And I put together a 5-minute sportscast and recorded it. And I understood that I was one of over 90 people because WIP was the place to be. That was the great place. And it still is. Those are magic call letters, WIP. I mean, that was one of the leading stations in America. And I'm proud to say it still is. I love everything about WIP. And so I auditioned, but with little hope. I mean, right. When you're dealing with people were coming all over, from all over the country to audition for this morning sports opportunity. So I auditioned, and I didn't hear anything. And that was January. And then in March, I was called out of the blue. I had long dismissed it from my mind and said, would you come down and do another audition? And I came down, and I did another audition and didn't even talk to the program director and went home. Didn't hear anything about it, and so April went by, and May went by, and I figured I didn't get it. And then suddenly, the first week of June, I got a phone call, and they asked me to come back to WIP. So I figured, wow, I'm still alive in this job. So I was sitting in the lobby waiting to see the program director and Charlie Swift, who was the man who was taking the vacation, sports director at WIP, came into the lobby, and he said, come here, kid. So I got up. He walked me down the hall. He walked me into the newsroom, over to a desk. He said, when I'm gone next Monday, here's where you'll be doing your sports from. I said, what? He said, oh, they didn't tell you? You've got the job. So I had a month at WIP, 1 month. I went back to WWDB. I was willing to give up my full-time job just for 1 month at WIP. But they said I didn't have to, that I could just not do my sports, do the morning sports at WIP, and do the afternoon news at WWDB. So I came back to WIP, and I was scared to death because here I was at the big station doing sports. That's number one. Number two, the disc jockey on WIP at the time was Ken Garland. Ken Garland had the largest audience of any personality. He had been a star.
Sounds like a star.
That I grew up listening to Ken Garland as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Ken Garland was, he wasn't in the newsroom where I did the sports, but he was in his own studio down the hall, but he was going to hear exactly what I did. And if Ken Garland didn't like me, he could make one phone call, and I was done. So I knew I was not only doing sports for the whole Philadelphia audience, but to Ken Garland, who was listening to me. So I got up my courage, and I got through that I gave it everything I had on that first sportscast at 6:05 on a Monday morning, and then I took a deep breath, and I had to say, it's 6:10 on WIP, time for the start of the Ken Garland Show, just like that. And then I pushed the button, and I heard nothing but dead air for about 3 seconds. But those 3 seconds sounded like 3 hours to me, And all of a sudden, Ken Garland came on and he said, wow, if I were Charlie Swift, I would hurry home from vacation. And by the time I left that building, they had signed me to do the pre- and post-game show and the coaches show.
Wow.
And my career was off and running at that point.
Wow, that must have been a pretty cool experience.
It was amazing. For you. It was amazing.
We all catch breaks in life. Some people fail to capitalize on them. Some make the best of their luck, but others turn that luck into gold. And that's exactly what Merrill Reese did.
And then how did the Eagles come into play, and how did that whole thing unravel?
Well, that was a long, long 5 years where I did nothing but pre- and post-game shows. And,
were you getting frustrated?
I was doing pre- and post-game shows. WWDB had become a talk show then, and I had gone back and been sports director, and I was doing Penn football. So I was still doing things. Something very strange happened. I had done the Ed Kiatt show. Ed Kiatt was the coach of the Eagles. And that first year, and he got fired after that and moved on. And 4 years down the road, I was still doing pre- and post-game shows, not going to the games, just from the studio. And I got a phone call on Saturday afternoon, and it was Ed Kiatt. And he said, Merle, he said, I'm back here in town because the Eagles were playing the Lions the next day. He was the defensive coach of the Lions. Mm-hmm. He invited me to meet him at the Marriott for dinner. So I had dinner with Ed, and we talked about the game, and tell me all about the Lions. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is amazing. I know all about the Detroit Lions, but I can't use this on the pregame show and the postgame show. So I went home, and I woke up the next morning set to go to WIP. All of a sudden, I got a phone call from Dean Tyler, who was the program director. And Dean said to me, Al Pollard's sick. Go to the stadium. You're doing the color with Charlie Swift. So I went to the stadium, and I did the color for that game. Well, I was just loaded with information. I knew all about the Lions from Ed Kiatt the night before, and the broadcast went really well. Next year, I was back doing the pre- and post-game show. At the end of that season, Al Pollard retired. And so now we go into the 77 season, and they hired me to do the color, which almost never happens to a broadcaster. It's always a former player or coach.
Right.
But based on that one live experience, I did the color. And then with two games to go, we got off the plane from Dallas the week before, and Charlie said to me, see you next week, kid. And I said, right, Charlie. And we were certainly friendly, not social friends, but we got along very well. He was always very nice to me. I learned a lot watching him do the play-by-play. And on Tuesday morning, I was getting set to go. I normally would get up. I would have the disc jockey at WWDB call me at 4:30 in the morning, and I'd run over to the station and do the morning sports. This time, I get a phone call, and I look at the clock, and it's 2:30. And I picked up the phone, and it was a guy named Tim Early, who was a friend of Charlie Swift's. And he called me, and I answered the phone, and the chilling words that came out of his mouth were, Charlie's dead. And turned out that Charlie had taken his own life.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know any of the whys and wherefores or anything else, but he had taken his own life. And I got up and I went to WWDB and I did an obituary and a commentary about Charlie Swift. And at 9 o'clock, when the switchboard opened, I got a phone call from Dean Tyler, and he said to me, you're doing the play-by-play Sunday. Go get a color man. And I got to know, as I mentioned, WWDB was the FM station. The AM station was WHAT, which was a rhythm and blues station. And many of the many of the African American athletes who were in town would come in to visit with the disc jockeys. So I got to become very friendly with the Phillies, Richie Allen, and the disc jockey was Sonny Hobson, the Mighty Burner, and he was great to me. And one of his friends was Herb Adderley, who's a Hall of Fame defensive back with the Packers, then went on to the Cowboys. And Herb lived in Philadelphia. So I grabbed Herb, and the two of us did the last two games of the 77 season. After that, there were thousands of auditions because people all over the country wanted that job. And it wasn't until the following spring that I got a call in the middle of the afternoon telling me that WIP was hiring me as the full-time sports director, play-by-play voice of the Eagles. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Somber circumstances, but later on when you got the job, I mean, what was that feeling like? I mean, it was like you made it?
Well, it kind of was. It was an amazing feeling. I would have rather have had the job under any other circumstances because not out of a tragedy, but time had gone on.
Right.
And I would have dreams. I would have dreams that winter that WIP had called to tell me that they had moved in another direction. And I would wake up the next morning feeling very, very relieved that it was just a dream. And other times I would have the dream that they were hiring me, and I would wake up the next morning disappointed that it was only a dream. I really didn't have the job.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, we were doing at WWDB, we were doing a show at the old Troc, which was the Burlesque House, mm-hmm. for our listeners because they were closing it. And they gave us a whole skit to do, and we went out and did it until late at night and with all of our audience there. And then I would run home and catch a few hours sleep. When they called me, I still had to do the Friday night show at the Troc. I got that call, and I was in a deep sleep, and Bruce Holbrook was the program director at the time, and he said, "Merrill, congratulations. You are our new sports director and play-by-play voice of the Eagles." And it was not only was it a dream, but it was just everything I've ever thought about in my whole life. And so I went in that Saturday to the program director to visit him at his house. His name was Win Moore, who was also on the air, the morning man. And I said, "Win, I just wanted to let you know and give you 2 weeks' notice that I'm going to WIP. And he said, "Great." He said, "I'm happy for you." They were wonderful. So I gave my notice. And Monday afternoon after I got off the air at WWDB, I was going to WIP to sign my contract. Mm-hmm. And I was driving down the expressway, and suddenly I broke out into a cold sweat, and I thought, what if I dreamt it? What if I just gave 2 weeks' notice and dreamt the whole thing, that it really didn't happen because I had so many dreams? But fortunately, this was for real.
Merrill has been married to his wife, Cindy, for 39 years, almost as long as he's been the voice of the Eagles, but not quite. They have two very successful children, and they will become grandparents for the first time in October. And when I asked Merrill to look back on his career, nothing beats what happened just 4 months ago.
I have a wonderful wife. Cindy and I will be married 39 years.
Did you guys meet at Temple?
No, oh. We met afterwards.
Okay.
Afterwards.
Okay.
Cindy's a little bit a little bit younger, but Cindy and I have been, this June we'll have been married 39 years. We like to kid and say it's really only 19 and a half if you don't count football seasons, but I've had the most wonderful, supportive, loving wife that anybody could ever have. I honest to goodness, she's great, and she even plays golf, so that's great. We have two wonderful children. I have a son, Nolan, who is
about the movies, right?
Nolan was the visual effects editor of Captain America, Gone with the Galaxy, and the recently released Rampage with Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. So he's out in Hollywood, and he shows up on the road a lot and keeps our stats from time to time. So and was with me in the booth for the Super Bowl.
Wow. So he's a big football,
he's a big football fan. Yeah. And Ida, our daughter Ida, is now married. She's been married for several years, and she and her husband John are expecting our first grandchild. And we know it's going to be a little boy because she came over to the house with a golf ball and said, "Dad, would you hit this in the backyard?" And they took out a wedge, and I hit it and it exploded and blue powder came out. And so this October, Ida and John are going to make us first-time grandparents.
When you look back, I mean, four decades of doing Eagles play-by-play, when you look back as a whole, and obviously we're fresh off a Super Bowl win, but is there a moment that sticks out, like specifically that you really love to harken back to, or was it the Super Bowl,
February 4th, 2018?
The Philadelphia Eagles are Super Bowl champions. Eagles fans everywhere, this is for you. Let the celebration begin.
There's nothing like that. If you're asking me for my favorite game of all time, single game, other than the Super Bowl, other than the Super Bowl. It's, I had a lot of them that went up with the miracle of the Herman Edwards fumble at the recovery, the Joe Pazarczyk fumble, and I had other great games, but my favorite was still December 19th, 2010, Eagles at the Giants, Eagles so bad that you just felt at that point that I gave the score at halftime. I said something like the Giants 21, the Eagles are still at their hotel, and then they came back. And Michael Vick marched them downfield. And then they recovered an onside kick. And Vick performed. That was the best half of quarterbacking I've ever seen. And then they came all the way back in the Giants stadium as Michael Vick hit Jeremy Maclin inside the left pylon to tie that game. Giants stadium was silent. And the defense held the Giants one more time. And the Giants punter, his name was Matt Dodge, went back to punt. And Mike Quick said, "No way is he punting it to DeSean Jackson." DeSean looks up. He muffs it. He picked it up. Jason Avant threw a big block downfield. The Red Sea parted, and DeSean Jackson ran and started dancing at the one-yard line. And I'm thinking, just get into the end zone. And he did, and the game was over.
One of your, one of your most memorable calls.
It was amazing.
I don't care if he jumps, dives.
Dives, whatever. It's
unbelievable.
He's at the 40. He's at the 45. This field. He's at the 40. He's got it. DeSean Jackson. I don't care if he jumps, dives. He's running around. And he's in the end zone. And he still scores. And the Eagles win.
Great moment.
So that would be the great game.
Any regrets or what ifs when you look back? You had the short Navy stint. Do you ever think, like, what if I would have did this, or what if I would have done that, or is this exactly your path?
I have no regrets. I have no regrets, and I have no desire to ever retire because I love this so much. I hope to do it for many, many years to come. So I love it. It's everything I thought it would be and more. I've had numerous opportunities to do network television, and every time the dream is right here. This is what I'd rather do than anything else in the world, in front of the best, passionate, most appreciative fans that anybody could ever have, for the team I grew up loving. So I have no regrets. I guess if there were regret, it's that the Eagles didn't win the Super Bowl in 2004. I was speaking at a leadership conference a number of weeks ago at the Bucks County Courthouse, and the speaker before me asked all the people, what did you find out about your job that you didn't know? That was one question. And why are you in the job that you're in? So when I got up to speak, I said, well, to answer my predecessor, why I'm in the job that I'm in, it's because I couldn't be the Eagles quarterback. And number two, what did you find out about your job that you didn't know when you began? And that is that it would take me 41 years to broadcast the Super Bowl championship.
Merrill Reese, the Philadelphia Eagles. Thanks again for listening to Wired This Way. Please subscribe and rate the show on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. Tweet me about the show at AND_Porter. If you'd like to sponsor the podcast, please email me at andrew.porter@entercom.com. That's ENTERCOM.com. Thanks again to Eric the Turtle Golden, who helped produce the show. Coming up next is the former Michigan State / Pro Bowl Eagles linebacker Ike Reese.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Whether you want to
buy, buy, buy
in a bear market or
sell, sell, sell
in a bull market, Jim Cramer can help you become a better investor. Mad Money, weeknights 6 Eastern. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.